Hello and welcome to SICE, the podcast, a student-led podcast out of Teachers College, Columbia University. As students of comparative international education, we started this podcast to connect academic research in the field to the current events that they inform and explain. My name is Shane Coleman, a doctoral candidate in the science education program here at Teachers College, and I will be your host for this episode. As a science teacher in the city of New York, as well as an activist and organizer, I come to science education looking for ways that we can inform current events and historical events in the work of science teaching. Today, I'm here with Dr. Daniel Morales Doyle. Danny is an associate professor of science education in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction at the University of Illinois Chicago. His scholarship considers how science education might be a catalyst for alternative futures that are more just and sustainable. Specifically, this work focuses on high school curriculum, teaching, and teacher education. He was a high school teacher in the Chicago Public Schools for just over a decade before joining the faculty at UIC. Danny, I'm really excited to interview you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Danny, I want to start by grounding our interview in a sentiment you had expressed in our first conversation, that we are often pulled in to justice work and have a privilege of using science and science education to affect the lived and material conditions of our communities. Would you mind sharing with us the story of how you believe it all started for you? How do you believe you had become pulled in to this work?
Thank you for that question, Shane. Some of the connections, some of the pull, I think, traces back to lessons I learned as a young person. I'll tell a quick story from when I was a high school chemistry student. Late one cold winter night when I was a sophomore in high school, my father and I were returning home from something in the family car. He abruptly pulled over two blocks from home. He grabbed a video camera, like a home camcorder that was stashed between the two front seats. And he pulled it out and he used it to capture billows of smoke that were pouring out of a hospital building across the street. And the building wasn't on fire, but he was actually filming one of two medical waste incinerators in the college town where I grew up. And my father, along with several of our neighbors, neighborhood activists, organizers, residents, had recently become aware of these facilities and their potential to harm public and ecological health in the neighborhood. Right, so he was documenting this late night emission to refute the hospital's claims that the incinerator operated infrequently and only at certain scheduled times. So this documentation was part of a larger community effort that was building to force the closure of these polluting facilities. Right, so whereas the surrounding college town was predominantly white, most of the residents in this neighborhood surrounding the incinerators were Black. And so the struggle to shut them down, shut down the medical waste incinerators, was my first exposure to the concept of environmental racism, which is the unequal distribution of environmental conditions that disproportionately benefits white communities and disproportionately harms communities of color. So not being Black myself, I was aware that I experienced unearned privilege that most of my neighbors did not. I also was aware that it was not a coincidence that both of these incinerators in our town were located on our side of the tracks. So being a high school chemistry student at the time, my father, who had never taken chemistry himself, challenged me to apply the knowledge from that class to understand the impact of the incinerators on our neighborhood and our health. He actually gave me readings that explained how burning polyvinyl chloride in the medical waste incinerators could produce polychlorinated dibenzodioxins, which are called dioxins for short. They're a class of highly toxic and carcinogenic substances that were being emitted by the incinerators. My parents wondered whether incinerators had anything to do with my younger brother's asthma. And so this was the first time that I remember science class being potentially relevant in my life and in my community. Chemistry was my favorite class at school. I had a really good chemistry teacher, but when my dad handed me those readings, I looked back at him and I said, you know, that's not what we're learning in chemistry class. So at the time I was a reluctant participant in the struggle. My parents had to sort of drag me out of bed on a Saturday morning to the protest, which became a victory celebration when the hospitals voluntarily shut down the facilities in face of the community resistance. So looking back on it, even though I was resistant to participate at the time, I see that the experience planted a seed about how science education might connect to social movements for environmental justice. So without telling three or four more stories from my life, I'll just say that few years later, I went into college. I was introduced to critical pedagogy, both the theory of it, and I actually got to see it in practice in the classroom. And so ever since then, I've been trying to figure out what critical pedagogies look like in science classes. And so if folks are interested in that progression, I had the chance to contribute a commentary to a really incredible special issue of Cultural Studies and Science Education on the influence of Paulo Freire. And I write a little bit more there. I think especially for students in comparative and international education, I recommend checking out that issue because there's a lot of great articles in there from around the world.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing. I think so much about how this notion of being pulled in is often from our parents, often from our community members, often from people that we're very lucky enough to meet. In that kind of way, I remember on campus as an undergraduate studying astronomy, and I was very much pulled into the work of activism and student organizing, but then I'd have to go to the computer lab later on and finish my astronomy, you know, lab exercises and papers. So we see the way that I think in your work and both in your experiences, you have kind of developed this approach to scholarship and science teaching. You discuss working with young people in their communities at the nexus of science education, inequity, and systems of oppression. Your work in justice-centered science pedagogy is kind of how I came to understand who you were. And your application of social justice in science issues highlights examples in theory as well as practice that science education can pursue, including encouraging students to consider the historical relationships between scientific development and processes of oppression, and contribute to students' understanding of and resistance against what you called tragic socio-political phenomena, examples like police violence, environmental racism, and U.S. colonialism abroad, and, of course, here. As a science educator, what do you believe today are the most salient frameworks upon which we teach and learn science?
It's a really good question. I like the way it leaves space for me to take up the word important in different ways. So I'll start from what I see as sort of the most influential frameworks, and then I'll talk about some amendments, additions, or other ways of thinking about those frameworks that have been useful for me. So I started as a full-time science teacher 20 years ago in 2003. And the two most important shifts that I've seen over that time really started picking up steam about 10 years ago, just as I was transitioning from teaching high school to teaching at the university. And those shifts are in the direction of, first of all, organizing curriculum around phenomenon. And second, really valuing the way students use practices to make sense of those phenomena. And I think those are really good shifts built on important frameworks. I also think they're not enough. Right. So I'll talk about some amendments or additions to the shifts that I think teachers should consider. Let me start by emphasizing that organizing curricula around phenomena is a big step forward from previous paradigms of having these laundry lists of canonical concepts organized into endless textbook chapters like the cell or chemical equilibrium or forces in motion. But if the phenomena-centered curricula are designed to coax and coach students into reproducing the same simplified explanations that they would have read in those textbooks a generation ago, then the power of the shift ends up being limited. And I think that sometimes happens when we prioritize the big ideas of science when we're selecting what to teach about, right? So in a community-centered or justice-centered approach, the difference is that we prioritize what's happening in students' lives, in their communities, and in our world when we design curricula. Right. And then we instead ask, what does learning science potentially have to offer to these goals, issues, aspirations that the students, the community, the educator in dialogue have identified as important? Right. So in that way, drawing much more on the frameworks of culturally relevant pedagogy, culturally sustaining pedagogies, critical pedagogies. Right. And so I think actually that shift suggests that we focus on themes rather than phenomena, right? And I don't mean to get too much into semantics and distinguishing themes versus phenomena, but I think there is an important distinction because I'm not talking about scientific themes. I'm talking about what Paulo Freire called generative themes, right? Which in science class we might call social justice science issues, right? And so these are themes that we know matter in local contexts, and also that we understand, as your question alluded to, that we understand the themes in historical, cultural, and political ways. right? So, for example, I've had the chance over my career to work with a really dynamic and powerful organization called the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization. And the themes that emerge from their grassroots campaigns against environmental racism often become the starting points for curriculum in the science department at the Greater Lawndale Little Village School for Social Justice. So the environmental racism of coal power plants was a theme that got taken up in curricula at the school. When I was in high school, the environmental racism of medical waste incinerators might have been a theme, right? So that brings me into this other part of the shift, which is prioritizing practices and student sense making. And these are shifts that open up science education in really important ways. For example, student sense making doesn't happen neatly within disciplinary boundaries, right? And the fact that students' thinking and students' questions aren't contained by disciplinary boundaries, for me, suggests another way that we might need to amend or rethink the shifts. So, for example, I always think of this set of questions raised by a truly transformative teacher who I've had the chance to work with for many years. Tiffany Childress Price is a teacher here in Chicago and a member of the group we call the Youth Participatory Science Collective. And I'm thinking about a point she made at one of our meetings. She said that her students wanted to know who decided that it was okay to put tetraethyl lead in gasoline. They wanted to know whose idea it was to put lead compounds in paint. And did they know about the toxicity of lead when they made those decisions, or how much did they know, right? And so those are historical questions, they're political questions, and they have scientific components, but the science isn't enough to answer them, right? So if we embrace teaching about themes and prioritizing students' practices and sense-making, then our teaching has to be transdisciplinary, right? And I say transdisciplinary instead of interdisciplinary for two reasons. The first one is that I think transdisciplinary opens up the disciplines themselves to critique. We can ask students to consider the oversights of chemistry, the historical injustices in the field of biology, or the limitations of physics. And then the second part that I think distinguishes transdisciplinary from interdisciplinary is that when we center these themes that matter in our lives, that matter in communities, that matter in the world, then we can try to put the sciences to work in service of our goals and in service of our questions, rather than centering the science and then asking, how does the science connect with our lives? Right. So it's a subtle reversal, but it's an important one, I think. So just really quick to expand on this idea of putting the sciences to work in service of our goals. My closest collaborator, Alejandra Frausto Aceves, has been pushing me to think about the role of science education in building the worlds that we want, right? Which implies more than just understanding or deconstructing the current world. And I think it's another reason to maybe shift from phenomena to themes, because generative themes can be exactly that. They can be generative. They might open up science education to more imagination, more creativity, like the term world building implies. So instead of asking students to engineer an electric car, we might ask them to consider what a just and sustainable transit system would look like. Right? Instead of presuming to teach students about healthy food choices, we can encourage them to dream about an equitable food system that's organized to sustain or reinvent heterogeneous heritage diets, which have always been healthy. Right? So those are some of the ideas that I think about.
Wow. First off, hearing you elaborate on the complexities both of teaching science education, but looking at science education as a culmination of transdisciplinary theories and practices really allows for this interrogation and allows for practical work to happen in the field of science ed that can be truly transformative. I also love the appeal to the notion of world building as one of the kind of critical reasons that we engage in educational practice. In a recent article, you and other scholars had discussed ways in which, when we talk about equity in science education, that equity does not happen in a vacuum. The group of scholars that you worked with investigated pre-service science teachers and their thoughts about the work of teaching through the analysis of political clarity, critical consciousness, and agency in science teaching. I'm thankful that my science teacher program was anchored in social justice because it prepared me for conversations with myself and my students about these structures. As a science teacher educator, what are some things that you've learned about preparing science teachers to enter the classroom now and in recent years?
It's another really excellent question. And I think it's important to start by just acknowledging that teaching has always been a really difficult job. And I think it's one that's gotten ever more difficult in the last few years. The unequal, uneven impact of the pandemic on physical and mental health make teaching a more difficult job. The recent spread of right-wing attacks on the curriculum make teaching a more difficult job. And these developments exacerbate for me what was always the hardest part of teaching. A lot of us became teachers because we saw the potential for education to work towards equity, justice, cultural thriving, right? But very quickly, being in schools, learning about schools, we have to come to grips with the fact that schools were set up to produce the opposite, right? They've been set up as institutions of assimilation and workforce development, right? And that's not espousing some kind of conspiracy theory. These are open and explicit goals of compulsory schooling, right? And of course, they're highly racialized goals. Black, Indigenous, and Latinx students are positioned as being most in need of assimilation and are most often relegated to the lowest rungs of that workforce development hierarchy. And so that's the source of educational inequity, right? Schools are not failing. They're doing what they were always designed to do, right? So there are currently, as I alluded to a moment ago, some disagreements about whether we should teach that kind of reality, those kind of historical facts in schools. But when it comes to the basic goals of workforce development and assimilation, you hear those kinds of themes in political speeches all the time from politicians in both parties, right? Think about the school day starting with the Pledge of Allegiance. Think about all the rhetoric around the STEM workforce, right? So blindly inculcating students with patriotism and corporate values are maybe the only two things that mainstream politicians can agree on right now, right? So, but as teachers who believe that education can offer something more liberating, more expansive, how do we think about our work in these systems? Right. So learning to negotiate those contradictions, I think, is a really important part of learning how to teach because it gets complicated and looks different in different moments. Students deserve opportunities to be successful in the system as much as we might critique it. Right. They deserve opportunities to follow those pathways to becoming doctors and engineers who in turn can serve their communities. Right. And along that way, they shouldn't have to conform to normative notions of success, to normative notions of what it means to be scientific, in order to access those opportunities that they deserve and that they need, right? So if some aspects of the system seem to require and reward, though, that kind of conformity, what does it mean for a teacher's curriculum or teaching practices, right? So learning to negotiate those tensions in different contexts across different moments, I think is a really important part of learning how to teach. And I don't think it's something you can learn in 1 year or even 4 years. You know, it's really complicated to learn to respond to each of your students' own goals, strengths, and aspirations, let alone given a context where you're working for a system that was sort of set up in opposition to your goals, right? So I start from there and I tell my students who are pre-service teachers that our program is about learning how to learn how to teach, right? And so some of you look at me like, dude, what are you talking about? That's super circular and repetitive. But it's really what I think teacher education does. Teacher education helps new teachers build the structures, processes, habits, and practices that allow them to keep learning how to teach throughout their career, right? In other words, they're learning how to learn how to teach. So it sounds circular, but I think it's actually what we do. And I don't mean it. I think it's probably clear, but just to emphasize, we're learning how to learn how to teach, not in a decontextual, ahistorical kind of way. There's no such thing for me as best practices. There's no such thing as universally good teaching. But instead, building those structures, habits, processes, and practices begin with learning to sit in the contradictions of being an employee of a school system that has likely caused your students and their families a lot of harm. And then asking yourself, okay, how do I proceed from here?
Again, so many aspects of that. I think both our audience and the greater community of those who seek to be in the sciences and teach the sciences and learn the sciences benefit so much from this contextual approach, from this thematic approach that allows us to be part of the thing that we are learning to do. When I was becoming a science teacher, I cannot say confidently that I had any idea how to begin to address the social political issues that would, of course, were happening, but in science teaching specifically. And let alone I had, I think, a lot of issues communicating my ambitions to other teachers, to students and their families. I want to close with a more general question. However, I think that we've been leading down a pathway that really allows us to engage in rigorous thought. How would you explain this notion of justice-centered science education to parents, community members, and youth, to people who, you know, for many reasons and purposes, may think that science should be phenomenological and should just teach the standard curriculum?
It's another really good question. It's something that I think all of us who work in universities should be asked to do more often. So one way that I might respond to that question is by telling the medical waste incinerator story that I started with. Right. Unfortunately, I have other similar stories from the various neighborhoods where I've lived and worked. Right. So a few years ago, I got an image of the program for the varsity baseball team at the public high school in the neighborhood where I live in the south side of Chicago. Right. So on one hand, that was a super normal text. I've lived in the area for 14 years. My children have actually played organized baseball, softball since they were preschoolers and t-ball. So I have dozens of friends, contacts stored in my phone who are members of the local community of baseball coaches, parents, volunteers. But this text of a baseball program actually came from somebody in the science education community instead, right? So it was a chemistry teacher at the local high school. His name is Tomasz Rosky, and he sent me the program because he noticed one of the team's sponsors. So there alongside the baseball roster was an advertisement for an industrial chemical plant that's about a mile from the school, right? And the ad explained that this plant, and I'll quote the ad that was in the high school baseball program, this plant produces inorganic chemical catalysts that are used in the petroleum refining and specialty petrochemical industries, right? So this was in the high school baseball program. Now, if young people in my community don't learn how to break down what that ad means in chemistry class, where are they going to get a chance to examine that, right? And this was something brought to them. It's in their baseball program. It's not like we as teachers went searching for it, right? Where else besides chemistry class will they be asked to consider what happens inside of this big industrial building that casts an afternoon shadow over the popular taqueria across the street? And who better than their chemistry teacher to invite them to think about the petrochemical industry and what it means for our neighborhood, what it means for our world in the midst of a climate crisis, right? Or better yet, at what other times in their busy lives will they be asked to imagine what else they might want to see on that block, right? So chemistry class can't just be balancing equations, learning about the periodic table, or even explaining why nail rusts. It's about engaging young people, as we talked about before, with building new worlds. New worlds that are better for them, for their families, and for those who come after them, right? That's the world building that Alejandro Fausto Cepes pushes me on. And that's one way that I talk about the work with folks in my neighborhood, including my own children. Ultimately, that's why I teach the way I do, because I believe in the power of young people to build better worlds.
And sincerely, I think that both students, both pre-service teachers, both your colleagues, and me especially, have gained so much access to the imagination that is required to even offer chances for this change. I heavily agree with the sentiment that who better than a science teacher, who better than a physics teacher, who better than a chemistry teacher or biology or English? But looking at this within the sciences is definitely offering this approach to justice-centered science education that has such power and has such merit in the world of scholarship, theory, and practice. As we close out, is there anything else that you would like to share? Any work that you're currently working on or things that you're a part of that you want to make sure are known?
I just want to express appreciation for inviting me into this dialogue. I'm really excited to keep working with the Youth Participatory Science Collective here in Chicago. And we're starting to think about ways that we can begin from generative themes locally to develop science curriculum, but that make more explicit connection with communities and other places that are linked by some of the themes and issues that we're talking about. The ways in which the material economy, the ways in which the changing climate connect us all, so that we can start from local themes and then think broader in terms of building worlds that are more just, sustainable, culturally thriving.
Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today. I can't say any more about the impact and continued impact, I think, of your work in science education. From New York all the way to Chicago, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
SCICE the Podcast is part of the Current Issues in Comparative Education, an open access journal in the field of comparative education. SCICE is the oldest open student-led journal in the field. SCICE the Podcast wishes to thank doctoral and master students who have contributed to this episode. Credits can be found on our website, scicethepodcast.weebly.com.